Hi, welcome to this evening's event. Thank you very much for joining us. It's a great pleasure to see you all and to welcome you to Zoe Hurley's book launch, which is very exciting. The title of the book and tonight's event is Social Media Influencing in the City of Likes, Dubai and the Post-Digital Condition. So again, welcome. My name is Dr. Polly Withers. I'm the chair tonight. I'm a Levi Humoli Career Fellow at the LSE Middle East Centre, where I work on issues related to gender and sexuality in media and popular culture in the Levant, but Palestine mainly, also Jordan a little bit. So I will be chairing tonight. So just very quickly, some housekeeping. The event's for an hour, so we'll finish at 7. There are also leaflets like this throughout the room, which give you a discount to the book, and I think Zoe has some copies of the book.
Yeah, we've got a few.
But otherwise, there is a discount that you can use online with the publisher, so do grab that if you want to. Okay, so I'm going to move on just to introducing our speakers, and then we'll get going. So our fabulous Zoe Hurley is a visiting fellow at the LSE Middle East Centre and assistant professor in the College of Interdisciplinary Studies at Zayed University Dubai in the UAE. Her research focuses on post-digital cultures, feminist semiotics, and social media in the Arabian Gulf. She is the president of the Gulf Association of Semiotic Studies. With over two decades of experience in the GCC and Southeast Asia, and then on my left is Sarah Hopkins, who is our second discussant of the evening. Sarah is an assistant professor slash lecturer at the University of St Andrews in the UK. She has previously worked in higher education in the UAE, Canada and Japan. Her research interests include world Englishes, language and identity, language policy, translingual practice, linguistic ethnography, linguistic landscapes and English medium instruction. Sarah is the author of The Impact of Global English on Cultural Identities in the United Arab Emirates, which was published with Routledge in 2020, and she's the co-editor of Linguistic Identities in the Arabian Gulf States, which was also published with Routledge in 2020. So, we'll hand over to Zoe. It's a very exciting talk.
Thanks very much, Polly, for the introduction, and thank you to the Middle East Centre for hosting the event, and to Nadine for doing the logistics, and thanks to everyone who's attending, especially the discussants who Tariq's come from Saudi, and Sarah who's come from Oxford. So I hope that you've had a minute to observe the photographs on the screen, and my idea was to kind of go without the normal PowerPoint that we kind of point to. So I've chosen these images, and most of them come from a Facebook nostalgia group called Dubai Days. And there's a few from some of the influencers that I interviewed for the book, so you'll see those as well. Now, when talking about images, and that's something that I do a lot in the book, The visual scholar Gillian Rose reminds us that it's really crucial to identify the purpose, the site of production, the consumption and possible interpretations of the image that you're looking at. So in terms of purpose, I selected these photos not only because they're really interesting, but since they've been shared by everyday social media users on Facebook, reminiscing about old Dubai, so a city that was formed in 1971. And in terms of their site of production, that most of the images come from Facebook, a platform that is mainly used by an older demographic, and these images are, an object of nostalgia. And in terms of consumption, they represent collective memories of the traditional a frige or neighbourhood by Dubai's transnational residents. So taken collectively, I think that the images demonstrate that interpretations of Dubai are not limited to a single frame, but diverse transnational histories, memories, affect and counter spaces. They should remind us that social media users in Dubai come from across the global south, and each construct a slightly differing picture of the emirate due to their own intersectional backgrounds. So the book that I'm talking about today was titled Social Media Influencing in the City of Likes, in reference to the economies of clicks from liking a place, a service, or a person on social media. Because obviously those clicks are linked to beacons of data that the platforms can sell to corporations and advertisers. So although Dubai seems to have no obvious natural or historical attractions, it's managed to reinvent itself, or invent itself, as one of the most Instagrammable places on the globe due to its infinity pools, skyscrapers, and if you've been there, you'll know that it sets up social media frames all over the cityscape. So in that respect, it's profoundly post-digital, since Wi-Fi and social media are an artery of the cityscape. However, it's obviously not without its contradictions and grave inequalities. And in many ways, it's a city that itself is acting like an influencer. So to explain why Dubai is seeking eyeballs in the attention economy, the book defines what is meant by the post-digital condition. So post-digitalism is a critical paradigm concerned with the collapsed context of the offline, online life world. So there's no kind of binary. They inform one another. So drawing on this, the study presents walkthroughs of social media platforms, interviews with influencers and marketing managers. And it offers critical insights into why so many young people not only follow social media influencers, but also want to be one. And in doing so, the study reveals the challenges of neoliberal post-citizenship, whereby social media is turning us all into human brands. But before explaining how these issues were addressed, I'd like to clarify some of the things that the book didn't try to do. So it's not a manual or roadmap to becoming an influencer. And it's not an exhaustive political, sociological, or linguistic study. But neither is it a reductive narrative of Dubai as simply a crass, liminal, consumerist space. Third, it highlights and takes on board the exploitation of migrant workers in the Gulf. But at the same time, it looks at how migrants using social media in the emirate do not define themselves merely in terms of deficit. So while the study offers insights into platform capitalism more generally, and the algorithmic logics of platforms like TikTok have really changed the influencer landscape in nuanced ways more recently. So contemporary Dubai is a city with over 3 million people, 200 different nationalities, and the Emirati population make up only around 11%. And the main argument of the book is that since social media is, you know, turning us all into brands, influencing occurs at the intersectional, gendered, racial, religious and classed axis of Dubai's global visual economy. So to understand how we got here, we can consider social media's prehistories, as I did in the book. And I think it's really important to look at the prehistories, because people tend to write about social media, you know, often as if it's something entirely new. And taking a post-digital perspective, It's a shift away from a tech-centric focus on the medium. So reflecting on the rise of the Web 2.0 and the launch of social media platforms like MySpace, I don't know if anyone's old enough to remember MySpace in 2003 and Facebook in 2004. A lot of writing and theory about social media is often a shallow articulation of the rise of these early platforms, or perhaps reality television, and then perhaps cam girls in the noughties. However, as semioticians argue, visual signs were having a powerful effect on human societies long before the images of mass media. So without signs and symbols of holy figures, deities, there never would have been religion. And the influence was not only located in public spectacle or religious sites, but grew in parallel with popular entertainment and was grounded in cultural processes that are constituted by material social relations. So for Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote The Great Gatsby in 1925, Gatsby is the ultimate influencer. So he's a chancer, he has a mysterious income, he hosts flashy parties and projects an affected style as he embodies the tensions between old world influence, the allure of youth, beauty, spectacle, power and money. And I think it's, in many ways, this encapsulates how the Western media have tended to view Dubai. So in the book, I addressed the gap in influence of theory and zoomed in on social media's prehistories, which include theatre, vaudeville, early cinema, printing press, cigarette cards, advertising. But obviously, because the book is set in the Emirates, the book raises the point that the mass media is not an exclusively Western phenomena. And it talks about some of the genealogies of Arab media. One example is it discusses Arab circuses and vaudeville performers who began performing in the 19th century. And this includes the Ali Ben Abdullah troupe, who performed in New York in 1863 in the show The Alhambra Pavilion of the Children of the Desert. And this troupe promoted themselves as the only band of pure Bedouins who have ever visited America. But many of these acts performing under the guise of Arab were Christian Syrians and North Africans who were very aware that exoticism and Orientalism sells. So in Dubai, the rise of social media and reality television coincided with profound changes in the Arab world. So by 2009, there were over 500 Arabic language channels, hugely popular shows like Star Academy, broadcast by the Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation, were credited with emptying city streets and animating mosque sermons, opinion pages, and talk shows. And the shows provided new channels of engagement, which the Dubai government learned from. Subsequently, the Dubai government has been extremely shrewd in its deployment of social media influencers and recognition that Gen Z audiences are much more motivated by influencers than traditional media figures or politicians. So in 2022, Dubai Tourism broadcast influencer campaigns across 3,500 digital assets in 25 languages, and each of those campaigns represents the emirate in very different ways. So next I'll just talk briefly about the methodology that was developed to conceive of this enormous hybridity of Dubai's influencer canvas. So in terms of methodology, I there was daily engagements with images and videos on various social media platforms, and I worked with a number of research assistants, and together we collated a huge corpus of hashtags, URLs and images, which were stored on a portfolio software tool. So that enabled us to collect all of this data and to address it. I also carried out a number of in-depth interviews with influencers, and I interviewed mega influencers, so people with more than a million followers. And some of those influencers were my students, because I've been teaching at a university in Dubai for the last decade. But I also spoke to meso influencers who were kind of on the up, so people who've got more than 5,000. And I was very interested as well in micro influencers, so people with under 5,000 followers. And I also spoke to social media marketing managers, people in PR, and people who've kind of seen the whole phenomena rise. So, you know, in terms of my own positionality, from a post-digital perspective, it's really important to be self-reflexive about who you are as the author. And in the book, I highlight that by writing in the first person when I do so. And I'm clearly a middle-class white woman, and this informs my positionality. But what also informs my positionality is that I live and work in the Emirates, and any academic working in the Gulf has to critique the region in broad brush strokes and with sensitivity. And so the necessity of self-censorship is always at the back of our minds while we're writing in the Gulf, or even talking about it from afar. Similarly, fieldwork with social media influencers, I was very aware of the risks that they're taking. And I consider this young generation of influencers that I met to be really, really brave. And I think that they're brave because of the very harsh penalties that the Gulf has for people challenging the status quo or kind of disrupting social etiquette in the region. So sometimes I use some of the influencers' names, and other times I respect their anonymity in order to not endanger them. So out of this extensive body of fieldwork and gathering all this data, I have the book's 10 chapters. I'm going to really briefly summarise some of the interesting cases that came out of that. So Emirati, Gulf and Arab influencers I spoke with are using social media in both marketized and really political terms. So often in the literature, these things are considered a dichotomy, but I think it's slightly different in the Gulf context. And influencers that I spoke to are raising concerns about issues like Palestine, and they also call out Meta for the shadow banning that they do to influencers talking about these issues, and they raise a number of issues that are considered controversial in the Gulf context, and this includes topics about sexuality, non-binary identity, nationalism, and changes in the region. So I also spoke to foodie influencers, and so one example is that these South Asian Instagrammers called Where's My Food At, who just blog about eating. And I think this is really important because we kind of really need to understand, why is it that people are always photographing their food? And people see, we all do it probably. I definitely do. Now, from a semiotic perspective, this is because food has always carried a great deal of significance as a system of communication and political marker of culture, class, ethnicity, and identity. Now, in the Dubai context, whereby the majority of its residents, they do not have citizenship or access to the democratic process, So food becomes a really important substitute for political choice and contributes to what Jody Dean calls communicative capitalism. Now, Dean says that in the absence of a welfare state, rights and democracies, social actors become resilient content creators and consumers. So in my study, I found that influencers' projections of consumerist status symbols, like Dubai's expensive architecture, flashy cars, Rolexes, plastic surgery, have become almost sublimations for democracy and sexual desire. And in fact, they seem to replace both of these things altogether in replace of, you know, the me economy. So we have this really like hardened neoliberalism, this individualized identities that we can see on social media. Now, in terms of Western influencers, obviously Westerners are not a monolith. And it's revealed that the reality of being an influencer in Dubai contrasts significantly from the British tabloids' depiction. So while there are a number of wealthy influencers and creatives who have been invited by Dubai Tourism, and more recently they're being given golden visas, which are 10-year visas that allow them to remain, obviously not everyone monetizes their social media content to the same extent. And I interviewed this Australian estate agent, and estate agents in Dubai aren't paid a salary, they get commission. And you know, during COVID, he wasn't earning anything. And at the same time, as you can imagine, he was promoting this incredibly lavish life on social media. Now, I spoke to another British influencer, Derek Best, who explained how he came to Dubai on holiday with a single suitcase, and he's still there 12 years later. And he told me, he called this the hard pack up. And he explained that, you know, he didn't have much to go back to in the UK, and he had that single suitcase. He just decided to stay on, and becoming an influencer was really pivotal to his financial survival. And he got involved in other activities like crypto, playing football, being on the radio, modeling. And he actually converted to Islam and started going under the Instagram handle, the Black Arab Official. And he said that he found Dubai to be much more inclusive than the part of South London that he's from. And he felt a kind of belonging. And in turn, he appealed to Dubai audiences, so because he's 6'7" and he described himself as a walking, talking Burj Khalifa. And I think that this catchphrase reveals how Dubai afforded Derek important symbols of identity that perhaps differed to the symbols of identity available to him in Britain, or you know, or lack thereof. But you know, at the same time, while these symbols are not a substitute for citizenship, I think that this example does highlight the ambivalence of both. Now, in the case of working class migrant social media influencers, the study of TikTok and interviews with micro influencers suggests that a lot of I spoke to domestic women workers mainly, and it really became apparent how they're using TikTok as a counter space. And so for a start, the TikTok hashtag overseas foreign workers of Dubai has over 61.2 million views, indicating the strong presence and size of the community. And one example of ambivalent content is a Filipina TikToker who made a video while cleaning the toilet and using the brush as a microphone as she sings and dances to quite an edgy tune. And I think that the performance is a kind of critique of her duties, but it also refutes her positionality as simply a victim or, you know, or her role there simply in terms of deficit. And then another interesting incident is when delivery drivers in Dubai, and they're working for the British startup company Deliveroo, use social media to organise a strike for better pay and conditions at the end of Ramadan, just the night before Eid. And so social media was really instrumental in organising this. You know, but however, while platforms like TikTok might afford brief pockets of resistance, they're obviously constrained by the commercial architectures of the platform and the upbeat logics of platforms like TikTok. So in the Dubai context, they enable government surveillance, and TikTokers have been arrested for defying local etiquette. All right, so this point brings me to the conclusion and some of the takeaways from the book. So influencing in Dubai occurs within post-digital bubbles. So it's very fragmented. And what Arjun Appadurai described as deterritorialized scapes. So deterritorialization involves separate tracks of data and experience and mediatization. Therefore, undermining any possibility of a unified public sphere or dialogue, which were ideals put forward by Jürgen Habermas. Now, although these values may no longer necessarily be the objectives of multiculturalism, social media economies are not an adequate substitute for citizenship or political participation. As earlier social media theorists like Henry Jenkins once claimed. Conversely, social media is in danger of leaving us merely with communicative capitalism. Migrants of all classes and nationalities continue to travel to the Gulf to escape conflicts and poverty, especially as it's proving more difficult to move, survive, or thrive in the West. The Gulf offers vital opportunities to earn remittances that can be sent to countries like Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Nepal, and elsewhere. However, the everyday reality of life in Dubai is a sharp contrast from the social media promotions that influencing, influencing would suggest, and that encourages migrants to move to the region. So in the process of eking out a living of likes, migrants may end up becoming estranged from their families, losing citizenship in their home context, and much worse. Meanwhile, big tech are turning a blind eye to the very visible trafficking of people on social media platforms. So in terms of the benefits, though, for Dubai, in becoming the world's capital of social media influencing, it might appear lucrative in the short term as it's deployed to support the UAE's ambition to transition from being an oil-dependent economy. But as an influencer itself, I would say Dubai emerges a bit like Fitzgerald's Gatsby. Through advertising itself via spectacle, it remains on shaky ground as an entity which thrives on notoriety, exhibition of the next big thrill, and guests who are invited to visit but never stay. Currently, it's facing growing competition from its neighbours, like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who are trying to get in on the act and launch themselves as influencers in the region to attract tourists, foreign workers, and investors, while deflecting from political inequalities. But influencer economies are not merely formless globalism. They're driven by specific historical forces, including colonial, post-colonial, and neoliberal governments. They help to generate algorithmic flows of capital in ways that are increasingly intangible and difficult to understand. While influencing precedes social media, my final takeaway is that influencing is integral to platform capitalism, which is distracting, dazzling, and deflecting from the root causes of inequality. So ultimately, in my opinion, I would say that the platforms are the biggest influencers of all.
Okay, great. Thanks, Zoe, for that really, really fascinating overview of your book. We're going to move to Sarah Hopkins, who I have already introduced.
So Zoe's book starts with a quote from the Prime Minister of the UAE. "Dubai will never settle for anything but first place." This quote rang true when I started reading Zoe's book on my way from Abu Dhabi to Dubai for the Emirates Literary Festival. I was in a taxi and I was watching what was around me and also reading the book. So with its abundance of Instagram-worthy sites, such as the Burj Khalifa, which is the world's tallest building, the new Museum of the Future, and the gigantic Dubai Frame, Dubai is commonly labeled the land of superlatives. Its glitz and glamour frequently dominate social media posts. However, Zoe points out in the book that the social conception of reality behind this popularized facade is much more complex, dynamic, and multi-layered than first appears. The book asks some key questions. What is a social media influencer? Why is Dubai behaving like one? And why should we care? Its 10 chapters address these core questions, as well as posing additional questions at the start of each chapter. This organizational feature of Zoe's book is effective, because readers can start at any given point and be clear about the purpose of each chapter as a standalone piece. And equally, central themes, theories, and concepts are interlaced throughout the volume, tying it together as a whole. To talk about the concepts and the framework in Zoe's book, one of the key concepts, as Zoe already mentioned, is the post-digital condition. And this is core to Zoe's book, and it recognises that digital technologies have provided new affordances for dialogue, ranging from sharing short messages, pictures, memes and videos on a range of different platforms, such as Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok and Twitter. The digital and the analogue fluidly merge into what is known as the post-digital condition. A further part of Zoe's book is her newly coined framework, which is the theoretical post-digital visual pentimenti. Zoe explains that the Italian word originates from a term used in art history, pentimento, which describes a painting where earlier images, forms and strokes have been changed or painted over. Zoe, in her study, uses this novel framework the novel framework involves a layering of methods, including interviews with influencers, marketeers, audience focus groups, and also the collection and analysis of an extensive corpus of hashtags, URLs, and screen grabs. And this new framework is a very useful contribution to the field, as well as providing an innovative research methodology which can be adapted by researchers across disciplines. After discussing the key concepts of the book, Zoe provides a very rich and fascinating influencer genealogy. The influencer figure is depicted as a semiotic emblem which indexes social aspirations, shifting identities and trajectories for progressing in the visual economy. Readers are taken on a journey following influencer figures throughout history, starting with the 17th century circuses, carnivals, early film and print media, to femme fatale Second World War figures. This journey continues with the rise of TV in the 1950s and countercultures of the 1960s, and human branding and icons in the 1980s onwards, including reality TV shows such as Big Brother and the Kardashians. Throughout her insightful analysis, Zoe cleverly links earlier influencer culture with the present-day like economy of social media influencers. She takes a decolonizing lens and contests universalism of Western perspectives when seeking to understand the importance of influencers in the Middle East and North Africa. The book also recognizes that there are a myriad of belongings in Dubai's cityscape. Zoe questions how social media influencers represent the Dubai cityscape to audiences, and whether these snapshots are correct or accurate. Zoe argues that traditional versus modern, or zero to hero dichotomies, need to be challenged. This reminds us of Rana Al-Mutawa's urban ethnographic work, where she questions authenticity being used as a symbol, being used as a synonym for tradition. She argues that residents of Dubai create meaningful social lives in so-called superficial spaces, or places which are assumed to be non-spaces. Zoe also argues that posts by playborers, and playborer means a mix between play and labor, may appear trivial. However, social media influencing can be a serious business with huge commercial and political stakes for young people in the region. So to talk about the study now, which the book presents, the book presents findings from an analysis of Dubai lifestyle influences and explores concepts of neoliberalism and self-branding. Zoe stresses through her analysis of the posts that neoliberal actors are not universal stock characters, but rather they're often self-actors who speak to audiences outside their countries of origin, social class, gender, and age groups. The study also involved analysing the Orientalist way Dubai is portrayed in the British media, which Zoe also mentioned. Zoe argues that Dubai is often seen in the British imagination as a shady, temporal, spatial staging post for suspect individuals. She uses interview data and global semiotic analysis to reveal how British influencers share aspects of their bucket list lives which seem fantastical to their global followers, such as hotel brunches and beach clubs every weekend. Zoe points out that although British influencers may not have substantial material assets, their livelihoods are sustained via visual affordances and associations with a neo-orientalist cityscape. Here, Zoe references Berlant's concept of cruel optimism, where social actors remain attached to unachievable fantasies of the good life. Towards the end of the book, Zoe turns to another sector of Dubai's super diverse makeup by including Dubai's mobile migrant women via theoretical snapshotting, a case study of TikTok, and audience focus groups. Rather than focusing on the exceptional, posts from these women tend to reveal everyday realities, as well as the symbolic shaping of people's perceptions of their lives via the use of hearts and flowers to portray happiness and belonging in domestic work contexts. Here, themes of platform sensibilities intersect with deterritorialized identities and vulnerabilities as post-digital emotional caregivers. There are many takeaways from the book, and Zoe mentions many takeaways, but it's very useful. In the book's structure, there is a handy list of bullet points at the end for take-home points. But for me, thinking about the biggest takeaway I got from the book I really like the way Zoe describes the Dubai landscape as a kaleidoscope of mirrors, because this reflects the complexities. Complexities are so much more than binaries, and the multiplicities that dominate the cityscape. If you're interested in further thoughts I have on the book, you can read a book review that I wrote on the book in the Journal of Post-Digital Science and Education, published last year, and of course, read the book itself.
Okay, we are rapidly running out of time. We can go a couple of minutes over, so I will allow us to do that. So I'm going to take two or three questions. One here, and then was that? No? Okay. And then we'll go there. Okay, so yeah, please. Can you introduce yourself as well?
Sure.
You?
Yeah. My name is Saad. I'm from Kuwait, living in Dubai, in the communication and PR sector. I've noticed that you built your book and collected the data directly from the influencers.
So not just influencers, but yeah, partly.
What I mean from the ecosystem of the influencers. My question is, how did you deal with some of the influencers who's interested to make money, as you said, part of their activity in the social media, while depending on fake followers, and that will give you maybe wrong impressions about the landscape of the influencers. And if the time allows, my second question is, how did you overcome the language barrier? You are in an Arabic city, and I would assume that you interviewed people with English language. How did you get your insights from the Arab-speaking influencers?
Yeah, so
I'm going to take a couple of questions just so. So we've got one there. Please, introduce yourself and just please stick to one question, just for the sake of time.
Hi, I'm Iona. I'm from the UK, but I grew up in Dubai. My question is relating to the recent introduction of more, not citizenship, but the sort of golden visas and what to say for longer periods of time. Has that, the people that you interviewed that had those types of visas or the ability to stay longer, do they have a different sense of belonging or a different connection to social media than those that didn't?
Okay, great, thank you. And then we'll take this.
So my name is Jua. My question relates a bit about the social aspect of it. So within your interviews, have you encountered any stories or successes that the influencers have been able to create some kind of change, to have some activism? Not particularly about Palestine, because I think it's more, we can all see it, but rather to reforming, for example, the Kafala system, more reforms for the social structure. So have there been any cases? And so have they been silenced, or have they been, how did the government deal with it?
Okay, great, thanks.
No, it's okay, I think everyone can hear me. So thank you for the question. So definitely in terms of fake followers, it's an issue that really started to develop a few years ago, and I've been in Dubai for the last decade. My PhD focused on social media. It's a kind of long-term project, and at Zayed University I teach social media courses, and as I said, quite a few of my students are influencers, and because I have my own family, I'm very, involved in the community, and through meeting one influencer, I got to meet more, and it snowballed. And so this thing about fake followers, it's very easy to buy fake followers. And I interviewed Starfish Influencer Agency, and so what they do is they want to look at the metrics, and so the influencer straight away has to share their insights from Instagram or TikTok. And then it's very easy to see how many likes, how many actual comments, how much real engagement an influence is getting. So it's very easy to see through the bots and some of the other marketing agencies I spoke to. Because the Dubai and the United Arab Emirates is so fragmented, they don't necessarily think that macro influencers will be a a good return on investment. So they're quite into niche audiences and targeting specific audiences. So it's not necessarily about huge numbers, it's about who will appeal to audiences. And then what they're also interested in, one big GMI, Global Media Insights, I interviewed those as well. They do a lot of infographics in the region. They'd like to know who the macro influencers are following and copying. So macro influencers like the, you know, Kylie Jenner, Kendall Jenner, like they, we know that they're always stealing people's content and refashioning it. And so this, some of the agencies are looking at, you know, where the macro influencers are getting their information, but it's all about actual engagement. In terms of language, well, I worked with Arabic speaking research assistants, and I did analyse lots of content that was translated, and yeah, that we spent quite a lot of time, and I got lots of help from Arabic speaking assistants. And I think that a limitation of the book is that I, you know, there are 200 languages actually spoken,
yeah.
And I think there's a lot for people who are interested in doing this kind of research. I've definitely just scratched the surface of the linguistic work, and this is Sarah's field actually, and that's, you know, a limitation as someone who works in the applied linguistics and translanguaging space. There's a lot of work to be done on the multifaceted linguistic landscape. Yeah, in terms of the golden visas, we were just talking about this belonging, because this is the big thing that that everyone who lives there, and you've grown up there, so it's such a kind of transient place, yet you have this attachment and memories, because you spend your, and anywhere that you spend your life and time and you make friendships, you become emotionally invested, you know, even if you don't like the place. So I think the golden visa has been introduced to keep people there and to convey a sense of belonging, but obviously the golden visa is only for people of a certain income, and it's, you know, it's been introduced since the invasion of, around the you know, invasion of Ukraine, and it's definitely there to help people invest their money in the region. So you have to earn over 30,000 dirham a month. So that's what, about 8,000 pounds?
Now offered for scholars, for academics.
Yeah, and but now they're just making it like more accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So before it was prestigious, people, and lots of influencers were given the golden visa.
Yeah.
So, and I've met lots of like British entrepreneurs, Russian investors, people from all over who've been given, just simply given the visas, and then other people are applying for them. And I think, yeah, people are lucky enough to have them. I'm sure they have a greater sense of belonging, and especially people who can sponsor their families, because, you know, it's a place where you can't have citizenship, but people live there for three generations, so they want their children and their families to be able to live with them. So again, I think it's not a simple answer on that one. And then, yeah, in terms of that's a really all interesting questions, but stories of change and activism, I'd say within very limited parameters. And I think that, you know, we had the year of tolerance. When was that? A couple of years
that
ago?
Was, 2018.
Yeah, so with the year of tolerance, it's a top-down decree that things should be more open. And so probably before that, like, I wouldn't necessarily even wouldn't have written a book like this. But some of the Emirati influencers, they are very outspoken. And then obviously there's people like Huda Katan. So, you know, she's of Iraqi American descent, but she's based in Dubai, built her empire. Like, she's such a politically outspoken figure. And I think it's great that she's using her platform to talk about issues. And I guess because she's so big, she can get away with it.
What's her name?
Huda Beauty.
Yeah, Huda Beauty, at Huda. She's got a whole, you know, cosmetics corporation. But I think actually, so Arabian Fox, that's a pseudonym, and she was talking about her sexuality, and she's really outspoken. But she also, you know, a lot of the influencers told me about the trolling and the hate and the death threats that they get online. And I think any influencer, in anyone who's opening themselves up to this public visibility will be on the receiving end of that. So it's not a happy ending. Not necessarily. But things are changing.
Okay, thank you. I'm afraid we are out and over time, but Zoe will be here, so I'm sure you can nab her if you've got a very quick question after we formally close. So yeah, thank you very much, Zoe, for sharing your wonderful research and your very exciting new book, and thank you for being here with us. It's very exciting.